She'd battled her way to a relatively svelte 160 pounds, 72.6 kilograms. She was exultant. She'd cut her carbohydrates. She'd exercised. She had a personal chef and a personal trainer. She did everything right. She had every advantage not available to the rest of us. So why did she gain back 40 pounds, 18 kilograms, by 2009? Why couldn't she keep the weight off? Why is long-standing obesity so difficult to treat? Time dependence in obesity is almost universally understood, but rarely acknowledged. Usually, obesity is a gradual process of gaining 1 to 2 pounds, 0.5 to 1 kilogram per year. Over a period of 25 years, though, that can add up to 50 extra pounds, 23 kilograms. Those who have been obese their entire lives find it extremely difficult to lose weight. In contrast, people with recent weight gain have a much, much easier time dropping the excess pounds. Conventional caloric theories of obesity assume that losing 10 pounds, 4.5 kilograms, is the same experience whether you've been overweight for 1 week or 1 decade. If you reduce the calories, the weight will be lost. But this is simply not true. Likewise, the carbohydrate insulin hypothesis makes no allowance for duration of obesity. Reducing carbohydrates should cause weight loss, regardless of how long you've been overweight. But that's not true either. But the time frame matters a lot. We may try to downplay its effects, but the idea that long-standing obesity is much more difficult to treat has the stench of truth. So we must acknowledge the phenomenon of time dependence. Obesity at age 17 has consequences that reach decades into the future. Any comprehensive theory of obesity must be able to explain why its duration matters so much. High insulin levels cause weight gain. Food choices play a role in raising insulin levels. But we are missing yet another pathway that increases insulin. One that is both time-dependent and independent of diet. Insulin resistance. Insulin resistance is Lex Luthor. It is the hidden force behind most of modern medicine's archenemies, including obesity, diabetes, fatty liver, Alzheimer's disease, heart disease, cancer, high blood pressure, and high cholesterol. But while Lex Luthor is fictional, the insulin resistance syndrome, also called the metabolic syndrome, is not. How do we develop resistance? The human body is characterized by the fundamental biological principle of homeostasis. If things change in one direction, the body reacts by changing in the opposite direction to return closer to its original state. For instance, if we become very cold, the body adapts by increasing body heat generation. If we become very hot, the body sweats to try to cool itself. Adaptability is a prerequisite for survival and generally holds true for all biological systems. In other words, the body develops resistance. The body resists change out of its comfort range by adapting to it. What happens in the case of insulin resistance? As discussed before, a hormone acts on a cell as a key that fits into a lock. When insulin, the key, no longer fits into the receptor, the lock, the cell is called insulin resistant. Because the fit is poor, the door does not open fully. As a result, less glucose enters. The cell senses that there is too little glucose inside. Instead, glucose is piling up outside the door. Starved for glucose, the cell demands more. To compensate, the body produces extra keys, insulin. The fit is still poor, but more doors are opened, allowing a normal amount of glucose to enter. Suppose that in the normal situation, we produce 10 keys, insulin. Each key opens a locked door that lets 2 glucose molecules inside. With 10 keys, 20 glucose molecules enter the cell. Under conditions of resistance, the key does not fully open the locked door. Only one glucose molecule is allowed in. With 10 keys, only 10 glucose molecules are allowed in. To compensate, we now produce a total of 20 keys. Now, 20 glucose molecules are allowed in, but only because we have increased the number of keys. As we develop insulin resistance, our bodies increase our insulin levels to get the same result, glucose in the cell. However, we pay the price in constantly elevated insulin levels. Why do we care? Because insulin resistance leads to high insulin levels, and as we've seen, high insulin levels cause obesity. But what caused the insulin resistance in the first place? Does the problem lie with the key, insulin, or the lock, insulin receptor? Insulin is the same hormone, whether found in an obese or a lean person. There's no difference in amino acid sequence or any other measurable quality. Therefore, the problem of insulin resistance must lie with the receptor. The insulin receptor does not respond properly and locks the glucose out of the cell. But why? To begin solving this puzzle, let us back up and look for clues from other biological systems. There are many examples of biological resistance. While they may not apply specifically to the insulin-insulin receptor problem, they may shed some light on the problem of resistance and show us where to begin. Antibiotic resistance. Let's start with antibiotic resistance. When new antibiotics are introduced, they kill virtually all the bacteria they're designed to kill. Over time, some bacteria develop the ability to survive high doses of these antibiotics. They've become drug-resistant, superbugs, and infections from them are difficult to treat and can sometimes lead to death. Superbug infections are a large and growing problem in many urban hospitals worldwide. All antibiotics have begun to lose their effectiveness due to resistance. Antibiotic resistance is not new. Alexander Fleming discovered penicillin in 1928. Mass production of it was perfected by 1942 with funds from the U.S. and British governments for use in World War II. In his 1945 Nobel lecture, Penicillin, Dr. Fleming correctly predicted the emergence of resistance. He said, "There is the danger that the ignorant man may easily underdose himself and by exposing his microbes to non-lethal quantities of the drug, make them resistant. Here is a hypothetical illustration. Mr. X has a sore throat. He buys some penicillin and gives himself not enough to kill the streptococci, but enough to educate them to resist penicillin." By 1947, the first cases of antibiotic resistance were reported. How did Dr. Fleming so confidently predict this development? He understood homeostasis. Exposure causes resistance. A biological system that becomes disturbed tries to go back to its original state. As we use an antibiotic more and more, organisms resistant to it are naturally selected to survive and reproduce. Eventually, these resistant organisms dominate, and the antibiotic becomes useless. To prevent the development of antibiotic resistance, we must severely curtail the use of antibiotics. Unfortunately, the knee-jerk reaction of many doctors to antibiotic resistance is to use more antibiotics to overcome the resistance, which backfires since it only leads to more resistance. Persistent, high-level use of antibiotics causes antibiotic resistance. Viral resistance. What about viral resistance? How do we become resistant to viruses like diphtheria, measles, or polio, for instance? Before the development of vaccines, it was viral infection itself that caused resistance to further infection. If you became infected with measles virus as a child, you'd be protected from reinfection with measles for the rest of your life. Most, though not all, viruses work this way. Exposure causes resistance. Vaccines work on exactly this principle. Edward Jenner, working in rural England, heard the common tale of milkmaids developing resistance to the fatal smallpox virus because they had contracted the mild cowpox virus. In 1796, he deliberately infected a young boy with cowpox and observed how he was subsequently protected from smallpox, a similar virus. Through being inoculated with a dead or weakened virus, we build up immunity without actually causing the full disease. In other words, viruses cause viral resistance. Higher doses, usually in the form of repeated vaccinations, cause more resistance. Drug resistance. When cocaine is taken for the first time, there is an intense reaction, the high. With each subsequent use of the drug, the high becomes less intense. Sometimes users start to take larger and larger doses to achieve the same high. Through exposure to the drug, the body develops resistance to its effects, a condition called tolerance. People can build up tolerance to narcotics, marijuana, nicotine, caffeine, alcohol, benzodiazepines, and nitroglycerin. The mechanism of drug resistance is well known. To produce a desired effect, drugs, like hormones, are like keys that fit into the locks of the receptors on the cell surface. Morphine, for example, acts upon opioid receptors to provide pain relief. When there is a prolonged and excessive exposure to drugs, the body reacts by decreasing the number of receptors. Once again, the fundamental biological principle of homeostasis is at work here. If there is too much stimulation, the cell receptors are downregulated, and the keys don't fit into the locks as well. The biological system returns closer to its original state. In other words, drugs cause drug resistance. Vicious cycles. The automatic response to the development of resistance is to increase the dosage. For example, in the case of antibiotic resistance, we respond by using more antibiotics. We use higher doses or newer drugs. The automatic response to drug resistance is to use more drugs. An alcoholic takes higher and higher doses of alcohol to beat the resistance, which temporarily overcomes the resistance. However, this behavior is clearly self-defeating. Since resistance develops in response to high, persistent levels, raising the dose, in fact, raises resistance. If a person uses larger amounts of cocaine, he or she develops greater resistance. As more antibiotics are used, more antibiotic resistance develops. This cycle continues until we simply can't go any higher. And it's a self-reinforcing cycle, a vicious cycle. Exposure leads to resistance. Resistance leads to higher exposure. And the cycle keeps going around. Using higher doses has a paradoxical effect. The effect of using more antibiotics is to make antibiotics less effective. The effect of using more cocaine is to make cocaine less effective. So, let's recap what we know. Antibiotics cause antibiotic resistance. High doses cause more resistance. Viruses cause viral resistance. High doses cause more resistance. Drugs cause drug resistance, tolerance. High doses cause more resistance. Now, let's go back and ask our original question. What causes insulin resistance? Insulin causes insulin resistance. If insulin resistance is similar to other forms of resistance, The first thing to look at is high, persistent levels of insulin itself. If we increase insulin levels, do we get insulin resistance? That's an easy hypothesis to test, and luckily, studies have already been conducted on it. Supporting evidence. An insulinoma is a rare tumor that secretes abnormally large amounts of insulin in the absence of any other significant disease. As the patient's insulin levels increase, his or her levels of insulin resistance increase in lockstep, a protective mechanism and a very good thing. If insulin resistance did not develop, the high insulin levels would rapidly lead to very, very low blood sugars. The resulting severe hypoglycemia would quickly lead to seizures and death. Since the body doesn't want to die, and neither do we, it protects itself by developing insulin resistance, demonstrating homeostasis. The resistance develops naturally to shield against the unusually large insulin levels. Insulin causes insulin resistance. Surgery to remove the insulinoma is the preferred treatment and dramatically lowers the patient's insulin levels. With the tumor gone, insulin resistance is also dramatically reversed, as well as associated conditions. So reversing the high insulin levels reverses insulin resistance. It is a simple matter to experimentally replicate the condition of an insulinoma. We can infuse higher than normal levels of insulin into a group of normal, healthy, non-diabetic volunteers. Can we induce insulin resistance? Absolutely. A 40-hour insulin infusion reduced the subject's ability to use glucose by a significant 15%. Put another way, they developed 15% greater insulin resistance. Here's the implication of this finding. I can make you insulin resistant. I can make anybody insulin resistant. All I need to do is give insulin. Even using normal physiological levels of insulin will yield the exact same result. Men with no previous history of obesity, pre-diabetes or diabetes, were given a 96-hour constant intravenous infusion of insulin. By the end, their insulin sensitivity dropped by 20% to 40%. The implications are simply staggering. With normal but persistent amounts of insulin alone, these healthy, young, lean men can be made insulin resistant. I can start these men on the road to diabetes and obesity simply by administering insulin, which causes insulin resistance. In the normal situation, of course, insulin levels do not remain persistently elevated like that. Insulin is most often prescribed in type 2 diabetes to control blood sugars, sometimes in very high doses. Our question is, do large doses of insulin cause insulin resistance? A 1993 study measured this effect. Patients were started on intensive insulin treatment. In 6 months, they went from no insulin to 100 units a day on average. Their blood sugars were very, very well controlled. But the more insulin they took, the more insulin resistance they got, a direct causal relationship as inseparable as a shadow is from a body. Even as their sugars got better, their diabetes was getting worse. These patients also gained an average of approximately 19 pounds, 8.7 kilograms, despite reducing their calorie intake by 300 calories per day. It didn't matter. Not only does insulin cause insulin resistance, it also causes weight gain. Time dependence and obesity. So we know that insulin causes insulin resistance. But insulin resistance also causes high insulin, a classic vicious or self-reinforcing cycle. The higher the insulin levels, the greater the insulin resistance. The greater the resistance, the higher the levels. The cycle keeps going around and around, one element reinforcing the other, until insulin is driven up to extremes. The longer the cycle continues, the worse it becomes. That's why obesity is so time-dependent. People who are stuck in this vicious cycle for decades develop significant insulin resistance. That resistance leads to high insulin levels that are independent of that person's diet. Even if you were to change your diet, the resistance will still keep your insulin levels high. If your insulin levels stay high, then your body set weight stays high. The thermostat is set high, and your weight will be drawn irresistibly upward. The fat get fatter. The longer you are obese, the harder it is to eradicate. But you already knew that. Oprah knew it. Everybody already knew it. Most current theories of obesity cannot explain this effect, so they instead ignore it. But obesity is time-dependent. Like rust, it takes time to develop. You can study moisture conditions and metal composition, but if you ignore the time-dependent nature of rust, you will not understand it. A diet high in foods that provoke an insulin response may initiate obesity, but over time, insulin resistance becomes a larger and larger part of the problem and can become, in fact, a major driver of high insulin levels. Obesity drives itself. A long-standing obesity cycle is extremely difficult to break, and dietary changes alone may not be sufficient. Which came first? There is an interesting chicken and egg problem here. High insulin leads to insulin resistance, and insulin resistance leads to high insulin. So, which one comes first? High insulin or strong insulin resistance? Both are possible. But the answer can be found by following the time course of obesity. In a 1994 study, researchers compared three groups of patients: non-obese, recently obese, less than 4.5 years, and long-standing obese, more than 4.5 years. The non-obese had lower insulin levels. This finding is expected. But both groups of obese subjects had equally high insulin levels, meaning that these levels go up but do not continue to go up over time. What about insulin resistance? At the very beginning of obesity, a person will manifest little insulin resistance, but it develops over time. The longer you are obese, the more insulin resistance you have. Gradually, that insulin resistance will cause even your fasting insulin levels to rise. The high insulin levels are the primary insult. Persistent high insulin levels lead gradually and eventually to insulin resistance. Insulin resistance, in turn, leads to higher insulin levels. But the crucial starting point of the vicious cycle is high insulin levels. Everything else follows and develops with time, and the fat get fatter. Compartmentalization of insulin resistance. How does insulin resistance produce obesity? We know that the hypothalamic area of the brain controls the body set weight, and that insulin plays a key role in resetting the body set weight up or down. As insulin resistance develops, does it develop in all the cells in the body, including the brain? If all cells are insulin resistant, then high levels of it should not increase the body set weight. However, all the cells in the body are not equally resistant. Insulin resistance is compartmentalized. The main compartments are the brain, liver, and muscle. Changing the resistance of one does not change resistance in the others. For example, hepatic liver insulin resistance does not affect insulin resistance in the brain or muscle. When we ingest excess carbohydrates, we develop hepatic insulin resistance. Significant dietary intervention will reverse the hepatic insulin resistance, but will have no effect on insulin resistance in the muscles or the brain. Lack of exercise may lead to insulin resistance in the muscles. Exercise will increase insulin sensitivity there, but has little effect on insulin resistance in the liver or brain. In response to hepatic or muscle insulin resistance, overall insulin levels increase. However, at the appetite centers in the hypothalamus, insulin's effect is unchanged. The brain is not resistant to insulin. When high insulin levels reach the brain, the insulin retains its full effect to raise body set weight. Persistence creates resistance. High normal levels by themselves cannot cause resistance. Otherwise, all of us would quickly develop crippling resistance. We are naturally defended against resistance because we secrete our hormones, cortisol, insulin, growth hormone, parathyroid hormone, or any other hormone in bursts. High levels of hormones are released at specific times to produce a specific effect. Afterward, the levels quickly drop and stay very low. Consider the body's daily rhythm. The hormone melatonin, produced by the pineal gland, is virtually undetectable during the day. As night falls, it begins to increase, and its levels peak in the early morning hours. Cortisol levels also rise in the early morning hours and spike just before we awaken. Growth hormone is secreted mostly in deep sleep and is usually undetectable during the day. Thyroid-stimulating hormone peaks in early morning. The periodic release of all these hormones is essential in preventing resistance. Whenever the body is exposed to a constant stimulus, it acclimates to it. Once again, homeostasis at work. Have you ever watched a baby sleep in a crowded, noisy airport? The ambient noise is very loud, but constant. The baby adapts by developing resistance to the noise. It basically just ignores it. Now imagine the same baby sleeping in a quiet house. A slight creak of the floorboards may be enough to wake him up. Even though it is not loud, it is very noticeable. The baby isn't used to the noise. High persistent levels create resistance. Hormones work in exactly the same way. Most of the time, hormone levels are low. Every so often, a brief pulse of hormone, thyroid, parathyroid, growth, insulin, whatever, comes along. After it passes, levels are very low again. By cycling between low and high levels, the body never gets a chance to adapt. The brief pulse of hormone is over long before resistance develops. What our body does, in effect, is to continually keep us in a quiet room. Every once in a while, we are momentarily exposed to a sound. Each time this happens, we experience the full effect. We are never given a chance to get accustomed to it, to develop resistance. High levels alone do not lead to resistance. There are two requirements for resistance: high hormonal levels and constant stimulus. We've known this for quite some time. In fact, we use this to our advantage in drug therapy for angina, chest pain. Patients prescribed a nitroglycerin patch are often given the instructions to put the patch on in the morning and take it off in the evening. By alternating periods of high drug effect and low drug effect, there is no chance for the body to develop resistance to the nitroglycerin. If the drug patch is worn constantly, it quickly becomes useless. Our body simply develops drug resistance. How does this apply to insulin and obesity? Consider the experiment described earlier that used constant infusions of insulin. Even healthy young men quickly developed insulin resistance, but the levels of insulin administered were normal. What changed? The periodic release. Normally, insulin is released in bursts, which prevents the development of insulin resistance. In the experimental condition, the constant bombardment of insulin led the body to downregulate its receptors and develop insulin resistance. Over time, Insulin resistance induces the body to produce even more insulin to overcome the resistance. In the case of insulin resistance, it comes down to both meal composition and meal timing, the two critical components of insulin resistance. The types of food eaten influence the insulin levels. Should we eat candy or olive oil? This is the question of macronutrient composition, or what to eat. However, the persistence of insulin plays a key role in the development of insulin resistance, so there is also the question of meal timing, or when to eat. Both components are equally important. Unfortunately, we spend obsessive amounts of time and energy trying to understand what we should be eating and devote virtually no time to when we should be eating. We are only seeing half the picture. 3 meals a day, no snacks. Let's turn back the clock to the U.S. in the 1960s. Food shortages from the war are a thing of the past. Obesity is not yet a major issue. Why not? After all, they ate Oreo cookies, Kit Kats, white bread, and pasta. They ate sugar, although not quite as much. They also ate 3 meals per day, with no snacks in between. Let's assume breakfast is taken at 8 a.m. and dinner at 6 p.m. That means that they have balanced 10 hours of eating with 14 hours of fasting. The periods of increased insulin, feeding, are balanced by periods of decreased insulin, fasting. Eating large amounts of refined carbohydrates like sugar and white bread makes for higher insulin peaks. So why was obesity slow to progress? The decisive difference is that there was a daily period of low insulin levels. Insulin resistance requires persistently high levels. The nightly fasting caused periods of very low insulin, so resistance could not develop. One of the key factors in obesity's development was removed. Pulses of insulin, meal times, are followed by a long fasting period, sleep, as illustrated in Figure 10.1. However, the situation changes entirely when we are constantly exposed to insulin. What would happen if daily eating opportunities are increased from 3 to 6, which is exactly what's happened since the 1970s? Moms everywhere knew that eating snacks all the time was a bad idea. It'll make you fat. You'll ruin your dinner. But nutritional authorities have now decided that snacking is actually good for us, that eating more often will make us thinner, as ridiculous as that sounds. Many obesity specialists and physicians suggest eating even more frequently, every 2.5 hours. An American survey of more than 60,000 adults and children revealed that in 1977, most people ate 3 times a day. By 2003, most people were eating 5 to 6 times a day. That is, 3 meals a day plus 2 to 3 snacks in between. The average time between meals has dropped 30%, from 271 minutes to 208 minutes. The balance between the fed state, insulin dominant, and the fasted state, insulin deficient, has been completely destroyed. See Figure 10.2. We now spend most of our time in the fed state. Is it any great mystery that we're gaining weight? But the story gets worse. Insulin resistance, in turn, leads to higher fasting insulin levels. Fasting insulin levels are normally low. Now, instead of starting the day with low insulin after the nightly fast, we are starting with high insulin. The persistence of high insulin levels leads to even more resistance. In other words, insulin resistance itself leads to more resistance, a vicious cycle. We have now fulfilled the two prerequisites of insulin resistance, high levels and persistence. Following a low-fat diet led to the inadvertent increase in refined carbohydrate consumption, which stimulates high levels of insulin, which contributes to weight gain. But in the development of obesity, the increase in meals is almost twice as important as the change in diet. We obsess about what we should eat. We eat foods that practically didn't exist 10 years ago. Quinoa, chia seeds, acai berries, all in the hopes of making us slim. But we spare not even a single thought as to when we should be eating. Several myths are often perpetuated to convince people that snacking is beneficial. The first myth is that eating frequently will increase your metabolic rate. Your metabolic rate does increase slightly after meals to digest your food, the thermogenic effect of food. However, the overall difference is extremely small. Eating 6 small meals per day causes the metabolic rate to go up 6 times a day, but only a little. Eating 3 larger meals per day causes metabolic rate to go up 3 times a day, but a lot each time. In the end, it's a wash. The total thermogenic effect of food over 24 hours for both the grazing and gorging strategies is the same. Neither yields a metabolic advantage. Eating more frequent meals does not aid in weight loss. The second myth is that eating frequently controls hunger, but evidence is impossible to find. Once people decided that grazing was better, I suppose all sorts of reasons were invented to justify it. Recent studies don't support this notion. The third myth is that eating frequently keeps blood glucose from becoming too low. But unless you have diabetes, your blood sugars are stable whether you eat 6 times a day or 6 times a month. People have fasted for prolonged periods without low blood sugar, the world record being 382 days. The human body has evolved mechanisms to deal with prolonged periods without food. The body instead burns fat for energy, and blood sugar levels remain in the normal range, even during prolonged fasting due to gluconeogenesis. We are eating all the time. Societal norms, which had previously frowned upon eating except at mealtimes, now permit eating anywhere, anytime. Government agencies and schools actively encourage snacking, something that previously had been heavily discouraged. We are taught to eat the minute we roll out of bed. We are taught to eat throughout the day and eat again just before sleep. We spend up to 18 hours in the insulin-dominant state, with only 6 hours insulin-deficient. Figure 10.3 illustrates how much the balance between the insulin-dominant and insulin-deficient states has changed. Crazier still, we have been brainwashed to believe that constant eating is somehow good for us. Not just acceptable, but healthy. In order to accommodate all those eating opportunities, societal norms have also changed. Previously, all eating was done at mealtimes at a table. Now, it is acceptable to eat anywhere. We can eat in the car. We can eat in the movie theater. We can eat in front of the TV. We can eat in front of the computer. We can eat while walking. We can eat while talking. We can eat in a box. We can eat with a fox. We can eat in a house. We can eat with a mouse. You get the picture. Millions of dollars are spent to give children snacks all day long. Then millions more are spent to combat childhood obesity. These same kids are berated for getting fat. Millions more are spent to fight obesity as adults. The increase in eating opportunities has led to persistence of high levels of insulin. Snacks, which tend to be high in refined carbohydrates, also tend to cause high levels of insulin. Under these conditions, we should expect the development of insulin resistance. We never consider the implications of the drastic changes we have made in meal timing. Think about it this way. In 1960, we ate 3 meals a day. There wasn't much obesity. In 2014, we eat 6 meals a day. There is an obesity epidemic. So, do you really think we should eat 6 meals a day? While movies such as Super Size Me get all the headlines, and while people screech about portion control, the main culprit lies completely hidden: the insidious snack. Indeed, many health professionals have been very vocal about increasing the number of eating occasions. This situation is just as crazy as it sounds. Eat more to weigh less. That doesn't even sound like it will work. And guess what? It doesn't. Part 4. The Social Phenomenon of Obesity. Chapter 11. Big Food, More Food, and the New Science of Diabesity. Fueling the increase in eating opportunities was the desire of big food companies to make more money. They created an entirely new category of food called snack food and promoted it relentlessly. They advertised on TV, print, radio, and internet. But there is an even more insidious form of advertising called sponsorship and research. Big Food sponsors many large nutritional organizations. And then there are the medical associations. In 1988, the American Heart Association decided that it would be a good idea to start accepting cash to put its heart check symbol on foods of otherwise dubious nutritional quality. The Center for Science in the Public Interest estimates that in 2002, the AHA received over $2 million from this program alone. Food companies paid $7,500 for 1 to 9 products, but there was a volume discount for more than 25 products. Exclusive deals were, of course, more expensive. In 2009, nutritional standouts such as Cocoa Puffs and Frosted Mini Wheats were still on the heart checklist. The 2013 Dallas Heart Walk, organized by the AHA, featured Frito-Lay as a prominent sponsor. The Heart and Stroke Foundation in Canada was no better. As noted on Dr. Yoni Friedhoff's blog, a bottle of grape juice proudly bearing the health check contained 10 teaspoons of sugar. The fact that these foods were pure sugar seemed not to bother anybody. Researchers and academic physicians, as key opinion leaders, were not to be ignored either. Many health professionals endorsed the use of artificial meal replacement shakes or bars, drugs, and surgery as evidence-based diet aids. Forget about eating a whole, unrefined natural foods diet. Forget about reducing added sugars and refined starches such as white bread. Consider the ingredient list of a popular meal replacement shake. The first 5 ingredients are water, corn maltodextrin, sugar, milk protein concentrate, and canola oil. This nauseating blend of water, sugar, and canola oil does not really meet my definition of healthy. In addition, impartiality, or the lack thereof, can be a serious issue when it comes to publishing medical and health information. The financial disclosures section of some papers published in journals and on the web can run for more than half a page. Funding sources have enormous influence on study results. In a 2007 study that looked specifically at soft drinks, Dr. David Ludwig from Harvard University found that accepting funds from companies whose products are reviewed increased the likelihood of a favorable result by approximately 700%. This finding is echoed in the work of Marion Nessel, professor of nutrition and food studies at New York University. In 2001, she concluded that it is difficult to find studies that did not come to conclusions favoring the sponsor's commercial interest. The fox, it seemed, was now guarding the henhouse. Shills for big food had been allowed to infiltrate the hallowed halls of medicine. Push fructose? No problem. Push obesity drugs? No problem. Push artificial meal replacement shakes? No problem. But the obesity epidemic couldn't very well be ignored, and a culprit had to be found. Calories was the perfect scapegoat. Eat fewer calories, they said, but eat more of everything else. There is no company that sells calories, nor is there a brand called Calories. There is no food called Calories. Nameless and faceless, Calories were the ideal stooge. Calories could now take all the blame. They say candy doesn't make you fat. Calories make you fat. They say that 100 calories of cola is just as likely as 100 calories of broccoli to make you fat. They say that a calorie is a calorie. Don't you know? But show me a single person that grew fat by eating too much steamed broccoli. I know it. You know it. Furthermore, we cannot simply eat our usual diet and add some fat or protein or snacks and expect to lose weight. Against all common sense, weight loss advice usually involves eating more. Just take a look at table 11.1. Why would anybody give such completely asinine advice? Because nobody makes any money when you eat less. If you take more supplements, the supplement companies make money. If you drink more milk, the dairy farmers make money. If you eat more breakfast, the breakfast food companies make money. The list goes on and on. One of the worst myths is that eating more frequently causes weight loss. Eat snacks to lose weight? It sounds pretty stupid. And it is. Snacking. It won't make you thin. Health professionals now heavily promote snacking, which previously had been heavily discouraged. But studies confirm that snacking means you eat more. Subjects given mandatory snacks would consume slightly fewer calories at the subsequent meal, but not enough to offset the extra calories of the snack itself. This finding held true for both fatty and sugary snacks. Increasing meal frequency does not result in weight loss. Your grandmother was right. Snacking will make you fat. Diet quality also suffers substantially because snacks tend to be very highly processed. This fact mainly benefits big food, since selling processed instead of real foods yields a much larger profit. The need for convenience and shelf life lends itself to refined carbohydrates. After all, cookies and crackers are mostly sugar and flour, and they don't spoil. Breakfast, the most important meal to skip? The majority of Americans identify breakfast as the most important meal of the day. Eating a hearty breakfast is considered a cornerstone of a healthy diet. Skipping it, we are told, will make us ravenously hungry and prone to overeat for the rest of the day. Although we think it's a universal truth, it's really only a North American custom. Many people in France, a famously skinny nation, drink coffee in the morning and skip breakfast. The French term for breakfast, petit déjeuner, little lunch, implicitly acknowledges that this meal should be kept small. The National Weight Control Registry was established in 1994 and monitors people who have maintained a weight loss of 30 pounds, 14 kilograms, for more than 1 year. The majority, 78%, of the National Weight Control Registry participants eat breakfast. This, we are told, is proof that eating breakfast aids weight loss. But what percentage of those who did not lose weight ate breakfast? Without knowing, it's impossible to draw any firm conclusions. What if 78% of those that did not lose weight also ate breakfast? This data is not available. Furthermore, the National Weight Control Registry itself is a highly self-selected population and not representative of the general population. For example, 77% of registrants are women, 82% are college-educated, and 95% are Caucasian. Furthermore, an association, for instance, between weight loss and eating breakfast, does not mean causality. A 2013 systematic review of breakfast eating found that most studies interpreted the available evidence in favor of their own bias. Authors who previously believed that breakfast protected against obesity interpreted the evidence as supportive. In fact, there are few controlled trials, and most of those show no protective effect from eating breakfast. It is simply not necessary to eat the minute we wake up. We imagine the need to fuel up for the day ahead. However, our body has already done that automatically. Every morning, just before we wake up, a natural circadian rhythm jolts our bodies with a heady mix of growth hormone, cortisol, epinephrine, and norepinephrine, adrenaline. This cocktail stimulates the liver to make new glucose, essentially giving us a shot of the good stuff to wake us up. This effect is called the dawn phenomenon, and it has been well described for decades. Many people are not hungry in the morning. The natural cortisol and adrenaline released stimulates a mild fight-or-flight response, which activates the sympathetic nervous system. Our bodies are gearing up for action in the morning, not for eating. All these hormones release glucose into the blood for quick energy. We're already gassed up and ready to go. There is simply no need to refuel with sugary cereals and bagels. Morning hunger is often a behavior learned over decades, starting in childhood. The word breakfast literally means the meal that breaks our fast, which is the period when we are sleeping and therefore not eating. If we eat our first meal at 12 noon, then grilled salmon salad will be our break-fast meal, and there's nothing wrong with that. A large breakfast is thought to reduce food intake throughout the rest of the day. However, such does not always seem to be the case. Studies show that lunch and dinner portions tend to stay constant, regardless of the amount of calories taken at breakfast. The more one eats at breakfast, the higher the total caloric intake over the entire day. Worse, taking breakfast increases the number of eating opportunities in a day. Breakfast eaters, therefore, tend to eat more and eat more often, a deadly combination. Furthermore, many people confess that they are not hungry first thing in the morning and force themselves to eat only because they feel that doing so is the healthy choice. As ridiculous as it sounds, many people force themselves to eat more in an effort to lose weight. In 2014, a 16-week randomized control trial of breakfast eating found that, contrary to widely espoused views, this had no discernible effect on weight loss. We are often told that skipping breakfast will shut down our metabolism. The Bath Breakfast Project, a randomized control trial, found that, contrary to popular belief, there was no metabolic adaptation to breakfast. Total energy expenditure was the same whether one ate breakfast or not. Breakfast eaters averaged 539 extra calories per day compared to those that skipped breakfast, a finding consistent with other trials. The main problem in the morning is that we are always in a rush. Therefore, we want the convenience, affordability, and shelf life of processed foods. Sugary cereals are the kings of the breakfast table, with children as the primary target. The vast majority, 73%, of children regularly eat sugary cereals. By contrast, only 12% regularly eat eggs at breakfast. Other easy-to-prepare foods like toast, bread, sugary yogurts, danishes, pancakes, donuts, muffins, instant oatmeal, and fruit juice are also popular. Clearly, the cheap, refined carbohydrate reigns supreme here. Breakfast is the most important meal of the day for big food. sensing the perfect opportunity to sell more highly profitable, highly processed breakfast foods, Big Food circled the easy money like sharks on wounded prey. "Eat breakfast," they thundered. "It's the most important meal of the day," they bellowed. Even better, here was an opportunity to educate the doctors, dietitians, and other medical professionals. Those people had a respectability Big Food could never achieve. So the money flowed. There are some common sense questions you can ask yourself about breakfast. Are you hungry at breakfast? If not, listen to your body and don't eat. Does breakfast make you hungry? If you eat a slice of toast and drink a glass of orange juice in the morning, are you hungry an hour later? If so, then don't eat breakfast. If you are hungry and want to eat breakfast, then do so. But avoid sugars and refined carbohydrates. Skipping breakfast does not give you the freedom to eat a Krispy Kreme donut as a mid-morning snack either. Fruits and vegetables. The facts. One of the most pervasive pieces of weight loss advice is to eat more fruits and vegetables, which are undeniably relatively healthy foods. However, if your goal is to lose weight, then it logically follows that deliberately eating more of a healthy food is not beneficial unless it replaces something else in your diet that is less healthy. However, nutritional guidelines don't state this. For example, the World Health Organization writes, "Prevention of obesity implies the need to promote the intake of fruits and vegetables." The 2010 Dietary Guidelines for Americans also stresses the importance of increasing consumption of fruits and vegetables. In fact, this recommendation has been part of dietary guidelines since its very inception. Fruits and vegetables are high in micronutrients, vitamins, water, and fiber. They may also contain antioxidants and other healthful phytochemicals. What is not explicit is that increased intake should displace less healthy foods in our diet. It's assumed that with the low energy density and high fiber of fruits and vegetables, our satiety will increase, and therefore will eat less of calorie-rich foods. If this strategy is the main mechanism of weight loss, our advice should be to replace bread with vegetables. But it is not. Our advice is simply to eat more fruits and vegetables. Can we really eat more to lose weight? In 2014, researchers gathered all available studies on increased intake of fruit and vegetable and weight loss. They could not find a single study to support this hypothesis. Combining all the studies did not show any weight loss benefit either. To put it simply, you cannot eat more to weigh less, even if the food you're eating more of is as healthy as vegetables. So, should we eat more fruits and vegetables? Yes, definitely. But only if they are replacing other unhealthier foods in your diet. Replace, not add. The new science of diabesity. The excessively high insulin resistance is the disease known as type 2 diabetes. High insulin resistance leads to elevated blood sugars, which are a symptom of this disease. In practical terms, this means that not only does insulin cause obesity, but also that insulin causes type 2 diabetes. The common root cause of both diseases is high, persistent insulin levels. Both are diseases of hyperinsulinemia, high insulin levels. Because they are so similar, both diseases are beginning to be observed as a syndrome, aptly termed diabesity. That high insulin levels cause both obesity and type 2 diabetes has profound implications. The treatment for both is to lower insulin levels, yet current treatments focus on increasing insulin levels, which is exactly wrong. Giving insulin for type 2 diabetes will worsen, not improve the disease. But can lowering insulin levels cure type 2 diabetes? Absolutely. But the many misunderstandings about type 2 diabetes would require another book to clarify. Our own disastrous, misguided dietary changes since the 1970s have created the diabesity debacle.